Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of the fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station, leading to cancer. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip. Through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems, only MagnaGrip eliminates 100% of all cancer-causing toxins within the station. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com.
In the world of firefighting and public safety, reliability is key. That's why for over two decades, first responders nationwide have trusted the Fire Store as their go-to source for essential equipment, apparel, and accessories. From top-of-the-line firefighting gear like helmets, boots, and thermal imaging cameras, the Fire Store has it all, tailored to the specific needs of our heroes on the front lines. But they don't stop there. Their extensive selection also includes EMS supplies, safety apparel like flame-resistant clothing and high-visibility gear, as well as a wide array of tools from hand tools to vehicle extrication tools, supporting public safety professionals in their duties. Partnered with industry leaders, the Fire Store's commitment to quality and excellence is unmatched, because when it comes to protecting communities, there's no room for compromise. Join the thousands of first responders who rely on the Fire Store. Visit thefirestore.com online or in-store today. The Fire Store, your reliable partner for fire and public safety equipment.
Welcome to tonight's Politics and Tactics. We got a nice, we're going to change it up a little bit for you tonight. So as you know, Politics and Tactics has two shows, a monthly Google Hangout and this show as well. And throughout the years, it's just gotten too taxing to produce both shows. So I wanted this show to move more onto what Capital Fire is doing. So RJ from Capital Fire has co-hosted Politics and Tactics when PJ was out dealing with some other external issues. Dave Polykoff has always been a co-host of this show along with Sam Villani. So I'm going to pass this Monday night show off to Capital Fire. Hopefully they'll take me on as a guest occasionally to check in and see how they're all doing. But we also wanted to take this show in more to discuss more about tactics and about the things that impact you every day on the job. And then PJ and I will still be doing Politics and Tactics. And you may very well see any one of these individuals pop in when PJ or I am out. But I'll pass it over to RJ to start with. RJ, you know, you're a consummate professional, somebody I've always held in very high esteem. You're out teaching all over the place. You're going to be at FDIC helping Dave Polykoff, keeping him on track in his workshop. He needs all the help he can get. So, we, you know, Sam saved him a couple times. So now they're passing the baton on to you. But I think that this is great. And you've done a lot for fire engineering over the years. And hopefully you'll continue to do more and more for fire engineering and FDIC. RJ.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. And thanks for having me. It's been an honor. For those that don't know, I grew up under Frank and his brother John in Middletown, Connecticut. So I am a Connecticut boy through and through. Yeah, thank you for having us. And hopefully we can make you guys proud with bringing some street style tactics to Monday nights.
Hey, RJ, not to interrupt you, but I didn't realize you were going to FDIC until tonight. And my brother John, for the very first time, is going to FDIC. In fact,
get out of here, man. That'll be so cool.
I haven't seen be John there. So what? Wow. They asked for the author's dinner, how many guests I'm bringing. I was like, well, two, but it's only one because they both are identical twins. And so it'll only look like I have one guest.
Man, that's so cool, because I haven't seen John since I was 18 years old when he sent me to Maryland.
He will be at FDIC.
I'm now 38 years old. Oh, wow. This is great. It's going to be cool, man. It's going to be cool. So, yeah, thanks for having us, Frank. It really, truly is an honor. And for all of us to be able to do this, because we're all friends. And, you know, we all bring, you know, much alike thoughts to the fire service. So it is really cool that we can all do this together. And on Monday nights, I always have something to talk about, especially as it relates to tactics, because you get a lot of different views. You know, these guys, all three of you guys have experience from, you know, firefighter all the way up to chief. And all of you guys pretty much are in chief roles right now, whereas I am stopping it with the experience of a firefighter all the way to a unit officer. So I think we're a well-rounded group that all brings a little something to the table as it relates to previous experience and things that we're currently living in our roles right now as unit officers and chief officers, and what we've known as, you know, regular guys from the floor. So I think it's really cool. And Frank, thank you so, so much for having us.
Dave, jump in.
So, yep, we wanted to kind of kick off the inaugural old show. It is Talking Tactics. Fire Engineering is presenting us, and again, you know, Frank, I appreciate you having the faith in us to continue on with this particular time slot. The show, it's been going on for such a long time. You know, we do get a lot of viewers. You know, we can check and see on the back end how many people view this show over the months, and it's a lot. So our word's getting out there. I don't think tactics ever gets old. I think it's something that we need to constantly talk about, because there are new things that are out there. You know, we can't possibly keep up with everything, but being able to just kind of sit back and do what we normally do when we all get together, we just, you know, we eat and breathe the fire service. We're that old regime. And you know, what we bring to the table, I think, is very pertinent. But the good thing is that we have the capacity to listen, and we listen to people that we teach. And like one of the things RJ always says is, just because we're standing on this side of the classroom talking doesn't mean we're any better than you. We're students of this profession as well. So being able to just talk tactics and kind of get back to our roots is a good thing. And to tack on what RJ said is, we may be in the chief role, but RJ is one of those kind of guys that keeps the chiefs grounded to make sure that, hey, don't forget where you friggin' came from. You know, the things that we're doing, you know, you did the same thing. Just because you're in a nice air conditioned car right now doesn't mean we're out there, you know, working any less. So RJ definitely keeps us, it keeps us even, and brings that perspective of what it's like going through that front door. We're not doing that like we used to anymore. So I think that this, you know, the three of us, and when you come on, Frank, and all the other guests that we're going to have, is going to be able to bring a lot to this show in the tactical realm, and thinking strategic and command and stuff like that. So again, appreciate you having the faith in us to carry on.
Yeah, absolutely.
We got Sam to pick up the slack whenever you guys are slacking.
Right.
That is true.
I just had to go on mute to redirect my 3-year-old back to watch PJ Mask.
But that's no different than directing firefighters. So that's why you're so good at your new job as a battalion chief.
They listen a little more at work.
I'd have thought it'd be the other way around.
No. Yeah.
Hey, so real quick, because I know we only have Frank for a little bit before he has to roll, but tonight's topic is going to be a cool one, and one that I know Frank has a high regard in. But tonight we were going to talk about search, and I think search is a really, really cool topic because there's so many different things to hit. I don't even think we'll hit all the things that we want to hit tonight as it relates to search. But while we have Frank, I want to ask Frank, and then I know this will be something that Frank can get started and throw a time bomb in it and roll away, and we'll be stuck with this. But so Frank, let me ask you, and then we can kick this off with this question. What do you think is one of the biggest challenges that we face in the fire service as it relates to search? And I know you can go on forever, but I'll let you start with it. And then I know right about then you'll have to leave, and we can take it from
there. All right, I'll start with two points. One that Sam and Dave discussed at a previous show that I think is important. I think one of the problems we have with search is the way we train for search. So we kind of get into that complacency thing where we want to break down everything into slower, you know, understandable components when we're teaching search, which is great to start off with. But we have to then demonstrate the skill at full speed And we have to get our firefighters to know that they have to search efficiently, effectively, but they gotta move. They gotta move with purpose. And I think that sometimes we set them up for failure during training because we're not doing the live burns. We have burned buildings with no furniture in them that doesn't get, or it's furniture that's bolted to the floor. I've never been to a house where furniture was bolted to the floor. That might be a Maryland thing, but nowhere else in America. But we have people searching open burn rooms. So you got to get, even if you can just smoke it up and you can't do the live burn, you got to smoke it up and set up the furniture and maybe walk them through. So you hit that walkthrough check mark, but then move the furniture because the exits won't move, but the furniture's got to move, and train on search. The other thing that I want to leave with you guys to talk about for search that I think gets missed is when we talk about moving with purpose, it's not just the problem at the recruit level. What we often see is you pull up to a structure, you're looking at the structure, and the chief declares that it's going to be a defensive operation. But then when they're conducting their 360, or somebody gets a look at the side of the building and realizes, oh, there's a room here that can be searched. If they slow down initially just because it's a defensive operation, it actually sets the victim up for failure. So I'm going to give you an example that I give in my search class that will be on Wednesday at FDIC. In a small town outside of the city of New Haven is North Haven, Connecticut. And they had a fire. The fire was a single family dwelling. Fire was through the roof. The officer told them to stretch a 2.5, and they were going defensive. And as that crew was slowing down, as any crew normally would do to get that line in place, the officer had the wherewithal to pop the front door. And when they popped the front door, there was a victim right behind the door. And then when they looked with the camera, they saw another victim. So now they're going to risk a lot to save a lot. And those were two saves. If that officer slowed down completely and said, okay, we're just going to focus on, you know, we got it through the roof, everything's going to slow down, those two people would have perished in that fire. So my hat's off to the North Haven Fire Department. But I think there's a lesson in that for all of us, is that when an operation is declared defensive, it doesn't mean that it doesn't become offensive if we have a known risk and it's an area where we think that they're, you know, we all seen how much fire a door will hold, that there may be one bedroom that can be searched quickly before you abandon and go completely defensive. So I'll start you guys off with that.
Yeah. So, man, it's so crazy that you brought up the whole search and empty space thing, because I feel like that is a huge problem that we have in training. And I think that we figured out, as many times as we travel all over teaching, you know, you can always get your hands on a structure, but you can't get your hands on a structure with it being as realistic as possible. You know, a lot of times we will, when we drop, you know, down at a place to teach, the first place we're going to is we're going to Goodwill. And you know, easy $60-$75 of our money we can drop in Goodwill. We can walk out of there with five shopping carts full of stuff. And you know, it's crazy because I never realized how many people don't do that, and they just take the building for what it is, to go train in the building and crawl around in an empty space. And you know, I will counter you with this, Frank. I have started to process this a little bit more. It's still not bad to train in empty spaces, because you know, I've learned the last couple fires that we've had at work have been in vacants that were nothing but squatters sitting in them, and had, you know, very, very little things in there. So I think that we have to find a balance of being able to keep it realistic, teaching people how we search in vacants with nothing in it, and teaching people how we search in structures with stuff in it as well.
Well, if you're searching the vacant and you find a bucket, don't tip it over. That's all.
Yeah, for sure. But you know, I never thought about that, and you know, I never realized how many people don't do that. And I'm glad you brought that up, because you know, a lot of times, even other training groups, we've trained with other training groups, and people were pretty shocked that we do those Goodwill runs. But that is something that I think is important to share with people listening tonight. That you know, when you get your hands on these structures, we have to try to make the training realistic as possible. And I mean, all the way down to taking, you know, getting clothes. We try to make beds and try to furnish the beds with actual comforters and fluffy comforters as if people would be in them. So I'm glad you brought that up. That is something very, very important. And I never realized how many people weren't doing that because they just didn't know how to go about it.
You know? RJ, and it's not just goodwill. If you work in a city with a housing authority, a lot of times when there's a vacant apartment, somebody vacates an apartment, they leave furniture. So I found, you know, reaching out to housing authority and saying, hey, do you have any furniture? Do you have an apartment that we can grab some furniture out? Also, in some of the affluent towns and communities across the country, they'll have a bulk trash pickup day where you can also find some good furniture on that day. I remember I was driving to give a speech at a union function. I had my city car, and Cheshire's like an affluent community in Connecticut, right next to Wallingford. And I saw a crib on the curb in this pile of trash. So I got a suit on. I stopped my car, popped the trunk. I'm on the pile of trash grabbing this crib because I'm like, oh, this crib is going to be great for training. Somebody pulled by, started filming me and said, wow, things are getting really tough in Cheshire.
Yeah. So I like that thought process that you brought, and you know, I'll kick it to Sam and Dave to give some of their thoughts as it relates to training and some of the things that you guys as chief officers expect out of us company officers as it relates to training and the aspect of training for searches and what you guys expect out of us company officers and line officers and down.
RJ, before they start, I'm at the witching hour, but I will see everybody at FDIC. I'm so glad that you're going. If you're going to FDIC, make sure you check out Dave's workshop. Make sure you check out all the things that FDIC and fire engineering has to offer. I'll be teaching a workshop on Tuesday, and I'll be teaching a classroom on Wednesday. Be sure to show up. If you don't learn anything, I promise I'll entertain you. Everybody have a great night. Capital Fire, you guys rock, and look forward to seeing you at FDIC.
See you, Frank.
So we'll kick it around, RJ. We started off, you know, Sam, you know, once you build on, you know, what RJ has built us up to is with the search and with the things that that you've seen, you know, coming off the app. Well, you've been in a battalion chief car now for a while, so kick it around.
Yeah, so I got two things for search. One, I wanted to throw a compliment at my home department for getting the acquired structures training program robust. I think we're on our third property now. Actually saw it in our, we have a planning document that the chiefs use to balance the movement in the, among the five battalions in our department. And I saw there were, slots for it tomorrow. It's my Kelly day tomorrow, so I won't be there, but I'm hoping my companies, at least, one set of companies gets to participate. And I know the last two, I think, have been multifamily dwellings, either apartment buildings or, actually, I think maybe both of them are apartment buildings. At any rate, I think that's a big part, a big component of our training, because we don't get the opportunity to, you know, get into a place and actually search it where we're not worrying about damaging something, or, you know, we're not at the academy with fixed items that we know, you know, we've seen 100 times or whatever. So that acquired the insert, whatever you want to call it, in-service training, acquired structures training, company training, where you can get out to an acquired dwelling, building, and do all the functions. And as you, you know, can probably guess, we're not burning it. We're doing, we can do destructive training, but we can't burn it. So they can, you know, vent windows, force doors, and actually do searches in real, real buildings with contents. So it's pretty awesome that they're doing that. Makes me wish I was a company officer again so I could participate in that level. But then also, you know, I think one of our biggest challenges moving forward, since we've embraced, controlling the flow path, which is, you know, huge, it's going to save lives for sure. Not only, civilian lives, but our lives, controlling that flow path, thinking about that when we're doing our searches, you know, that whole VES, VEIS, whatever you want to call it. if you take a window and you go into Venon or search, you're just searching that room, and there's already an open something in that building. It's imperative, especially if you think you might have an trapped occupant in that room you're searching, which we kind of always assume, right? We don't want to be like, this place is empty, but I'm going to search it. No, we're searching because we're hoping that if somebody's in there, we can save them. But closing that door to the hallway is huge. Controlling that flow path. I can tell you, doing the UL tech panel for residential size up in search and rescue, that was one of the huge things we noticed, how effective controlling that flow path by closing the door was, and how important it was for occupant survivability. So,
you know, I noticed that's a thing that, you know, is often overlooked in a lot of trainings that we do, which is controlling the door. I think that, you know, a lot of people get so tax saturated on the fact that they need to get the search, and when they dump down on the floor, a lot of times I've seen the last couple fires I've been to where VES was a thing, and also in training, people get so task saturated that when they get off the ladder into the floor, the first thing they do is go right to the bed or right to the closet or right to the objects that they're looking for, forgetting to control that door to protect them from the hallway to the room. And I'm glad you brought that up, man, because that is something that people tend to forget all the time because they're so focused on the search that they forget that isolation is a very important part of it. And I know, you know, that's one of the big arguments. Do we change the whole acronym to VEIS to VES? It's one of those things, you know what I mean? But I'm glad you brought up the importance of controlling that, because it's something that we need to make sure people are understanding to do, as it is one of the most important parts of that, so that we can have a better chance not only of being able to do the search, but also seeing.
Yeah,
being able to see in that compartment.
And I don't think we ever changed. We never changed a tactic. Anytime when it was Venon or search, we always were. You enter, you close, you isolate the room, and then you do your search. I think the isolation portion was entered on, kind of to build on what Sam was saying, is that you get so focused on searching the room, you forget to go to the door first. And a simple act of, you know, check the hallway real quick, obviously, before you shut the door, make sure nobody's laying right there. You shut the door, you'll get an immediate lift in that room, and you can knock the search out of that room pretty quick. One of the things that we talk about when we teach VEIS or VES, whatever, that corner trick, RJ, when, you know, being able to take a look at a single family dwelling, searching those upper floors and figuring out right away where the door is to the bedroom. And a lot of people don't understand what I'm saying. And I said, all right, if you live in a two-story house, picture standing in your front yard, look at the far right-hand bedroom, that outside wall. Where's the door to that bedroom? Is it on the right side on the outside wall, or is it on the left side? It's on the left side. I said 99% of the time, that's where those doors are going to be, opposite of that outside wall. And you just see a kind of a click. I said, so the moment you go through that window, understand that you need to be heading towards, away from that outside wall, towards that door. Shut the door, bang out your search, come back out the window you went in, because you went in there because it was a high-risk search. You couldn't get through the front door, or there was the fire conditions were to the point where you couldn't make it up to the stairs. So you have to come back out. If you decide you're going to make that hallway, you're no longer doing the Venon or search. You're putting yourself in the middle of, you want to call it a flow path. Once you open that door, you're putting yourself in the middle of where that fire was. Now the engine company gets water on the fire, and that fire is controlled, then maybe you can go out in that hallway and start searching, you know, either left or right. But it's all coordinated. It's all communicated. But that's the biggest thing, is we've had flow path since forever. We just never called it what it was. Now that we've kind of recognized what it is, we brought more attention to it. And it's the same thing with isolating that room. The other thing that gets me, and RJ, you and I were teaching, and I think we were in Atlanta, and I made the mistake of saying, we don't Venon or search every fire. And of course, there were some city guys there that were like, yes, we do. You know, and they kind of got a little, you know, dander up a little bit. And I said, okay, if you got the manpower, maybe you do. But for the normal departments, you know, we're not choosing to do that high risk search unless we don't have that alternative. Got decent amount of fire on the first floor, blocking those stairwells to get upstairs. But we need to get upstairs right away because we have a credible information that there are people in this place. Then yes, we're gonna you know, like Frank said, risk a lot, save a lot. We're gonna do that high risk search above the fire quickly. Knock out that room, come out. You know, if you've got a porch, move to the next room, knock out that search, come out. With a team of three, you can knock out a search on two or three bedrooms pretty quick on the front. And if you've got crews in the rear hitting those back bedrooms, you can knock out the second floor pretty quick through that coordination. So I'll get off my soapbox.
Yeah. No. It's good because I want to touch on one thing that you brought up, and there was one word in particular, which was credible. And I like to talk about this because of a bad experience that I had. And then the bad experience that I have will translate into Sam talking about the good experience that he had, and same exact situation. So this past weekend we were doing some training, live burn training, and we were dispatching new units to fires, different types of box alarms. Every couple, you know, we would dispatch it as house fire with reported people trapped, you know, and my job was to supervise a particular group that was assigned or tasked to the truck or the squad. And, you know, one of the things that I picked up on is that every one of those box alarms that was dispatched as reported people trapped, the number one question that needed to be asked never got asked. And, you know, I use that as a talking point with these students because it happened to me, right? So a lot of times people don't realize when we get dispatched as a house fire, building fire, whatever, reported people trapped, the number one question, and I'm a big rescue guy, right? And a big squad guy. But the number one question that I need an answer to right now is where? Where are they trapped, right? Because I think that a lot of times we don't want to spend energy. We don't want to spend time in areas that we don't need to. You know, one of the things that happened to me a couple of years ago, we had a fire. We had a report of people trapped. The occupant was on the phone with the dispatcher before they went unconscious, but couldn't get that information out to the dispatchers on where exactly they were. And so, you know, as a rescuer, I like to teach people and I like to tell people, if I can get that information of where they're trapped, that's the first place I'm starting my search. Now, how we get to that spot, whatever, right? If I have to take the interior stairs, if we vent in a search, whatever. But I think that that's one of the things I'm glad we were able to talk about tonight, which that is not really done well in these basic fire classes, is being able to have those guys and those girls who are on the search end be able to question the people on the other end as to where. And I wanted to make it my point to put out here tonight that if you guys are on the back end of this, you guys are the backstep firefighters or the unit officers, make that a part of your routine when you get dispatched, even going down the road, to ask, where are the people trapped at? Because that's where we want to direct our focus to starting the search. Now, you know, a lot of times they're not going to have that information for you or be able to get that information to you. And at that point in time, you have to rely on experience. And honestly, I think a lot of times experience is nothing more than, you know, what type of experience do you have? Where do you find most of your people? What time of day? Where are they located? And I honestly would plug the Firefighter Rescue Survey here, because they do a really, really good job of documenting that stuff for the fire service so that we can use those as references or materials to help us with that stuff. So I'm glad you brought that up, Dave, because that is something that I wanted to put out to people to make sure that, you know, as the people who are doing the searches, when we get dispatched to those incidents, to make sure that we're asking that question is, where are they located? And that's where we can start by directing our search. You know, I remember that, Sam, you remember what the fire you had, you know, that's the first question you asked as a command officer. I remember listening to the audio of that.
Yeah. Oriental Street. Yeah. And then, you know, I was I got really tied up, and I was so plussed that we had that person on. Well, we thought we had the person on the line. You know, I was asking, hey, have them make noise, have them beat on the wall, beat on something, make, you know, scream, whatever. You know, goes back to the whole, you know, using all your senses. You know, your sense of sight is reduced, and you know, they've done studies on this. You know, when one sense is reduced, the others are enhanced. So your sense of touch and your sense of hearing are going to be heightened. Well, if your sense of hearing's heightened, hopefully you'll hear that and be able to maybe be like, I think I heard that above us, or I heard it down the hallway here, or whatever. Heard that to the left, heard that to the right. And that's huge. You know, it's such an important, like, you know, it sucks because, you know, I look back, you know, we critique ourselves quite a bit, because we care, because we want to do as great a job as we can and improve upon, our duties on every, after every call, whatever. But, I just remember being like, man, I tied the radio up a lot trying to get this information out. But, I don't think I would have changed that because it's vital. If she could hit, you know, he or she, the trapped occupant, could make some type of noise, and cue us in, that's going to save a lot of time and hopefully get to them before they go unconscious. And, you know, sometimes you have a caller on the phone and they're already smoke sick. So they might not know where they are. They might be at that point of, impairment where they're not sure, you know, they've lost that part of their cognition, but telling them to beat on something, you know, you'd hope that maybe that would be something they could do or scream.
The one thing that I wanted to hit on, RJ, is, you know, that we talked about that credible, if you're dispatched for, you know, reported people trapped, if nobody's speaking up, that incident command, that first in battalion chief needs to be on the radio questioning communications is, you know, where is this person trapped? Who is saying that this person's trapped? Do you have the caller on the line? And get that information, because, you know, if you're a battalion chief and you don't have an aide like we don't, you're not able to look at your MDC while you're going down the road. So the other units might see what's on the MDC, but to be able to have that verbalized so everybody hears, they say they're on the second floor, whatever. Then you can come back, you know, command to whoever my first special service is, whether it's the rescue squad or the truck, are you direct on the location of this potential occupant? So we have to get that information out, and everybody has to hear it. So it's those critical messages. You know, your ECC is so used to typing stuff on the MDC, but not everybody's seeing that going down the road, especially if they're looking in the map books, they're talking to their crews or whatever. So we need to make sure if it's not happening for the unit officers, then those incident commanders, the battalion chiefs or the chiefs that are responding or whatever, need to pull communications and say, hey, what information do you have saying that these people are trapped, you know? And then we can start kind of gearing the people that direction, and we can start putting a search profile together as, okay, we've got a lot of fire on the first floor. We're not able to make a push in on the first floor very quickly. So we're going to have to go over ladders and do some type of high risk search. So it's important to question, you know, don't just take for granted that, hey, we got a report of people trapped and now we're just going to go in and, you know, search this whole house, but let's pinpoint, you know, they say they're trapped on the second floor, in the bedroom on the front of the house or whatever. We can start there, as opposed to it makes no sense to try to start searching the living room, the dining room, and the kitchen and all that. That's still going to get done, but our high target area is where we were getting those credible reports.
Yeah, so I agree with you, man. And I think that is really important that we shared that information with the people listening to us, because, you know, a lot of people, sometimes people don't know what they don't know. But I will plug Firefighter Rescue Survey one more time, only because they put out a lot of really good information. And it's surprising how many people still are not aware of what they do. But I can tell you that I have used their information in my own day-to-day operations, running fires, just by using their statistics. Some of the things that I have committed to memory are some of the graphs and some of the findings they've had, based off of where people occupy spaces, what time of day, what are the common hot spots where people are found, how many people did it take to remove them, you know. So as crazy as it sounds, I've been to many fires where I will play out all those different things in my head. Hey, we're going to a fire. It's reported people trapped. What time is it right now? So where would a normal person be occupying a space right now? And where would they be doing, you know what I mean? That kind of thing. And I honestly feel that this particular topic that we're talking about tonight is a great time to plug Firefighter Rescue Survey. I know those guys do a lot of great work documenting stuff for the American Fire Service. And of course, you know, everything is all based off of what people actually submit. But I would honestly say they do a really good job of keeping the data up to date. So for those who are watching or listening who have never knew about Firefighter Rescue Survey, now is a good time for us to plug it for them, because they do a really good job with that. But one of the things I would like to shift gears talking about search is the culture of search, right? So, you know, you also have to remember that people have to have a culture of aggressive, sorry, use the word aggressive, right? We have to have a culture of aggressive searching. And one of the things I will say that I think that the fire service as a whole, from here to Halifax, has done a really good job of making search being a priority of training and a priority topic in the fire service. And I want to put out a reason why I feel that it's important and why I'm proud of where we're going with the fire service as it relates to a culture of search. And this is my thought process on this, you know. So I think that the fire service has put out this understanding, if you would, to our community that we will always come for them, no matter what. And if you think about it, we have campaigns in the fire service that encourage people to stay in their house, right? Even my own house, you know, I have young kids that, you know, are in our house. Our kids, we preach to them that we want them to sleep with their door closed, you know. So we have a campaign in the fire service that's teaching people, regular civilians, to stay in their house. And we're telling them that we will come get them. So if that's the campaign that the fire service is standing behind, we have to have a culture that gets behind that, which is we are going to come for you. And I think that, you know, I have really been proud of the fire service for everybody mainly standing up to make search be a priority of topics for training. And I think it's important that we talk about that here tonight while we're talking about search, which is having an aggressive culture of people who are willing to put their life on the line to go and find our civilians, because we're encouraging them to stay in, we're encouraging them to stay in the house. So we have to have the ability to and the mindset and our departments have to have a culture to know that it is acceptable for us to go risk our life. There might be a time where we have to crawl across a burning floor beneath us to go find somebody. And if that's what it is, that's what we're willing to do. But we have to know that people are willing to stand up to do that. And that comes from having a good culture. Would you guys agree?
I agree. And people need to understand, you know, the whole close before you doze, that whole campaign of closing the door before they go to sleep. But, you know, before any of the young firefighters that are out here listening, you know, go out there and tell people, if your house is on fire, you need to stay inside. You need to understand that if it's a small fire and you can get out, get the fuck out. You know what I'm saying? But if you are in a situation where smoke in the hallway, you can't make it out, you have your door closed, you know, you get to that outside window, we're going to come get you. You know, 911's called, we're going to come get you. But having that door closed provides you that relief for that smoke and that heat to get to you. And my kids have been sleeping with their doors closed forever. We had to end up putting cat doors because the cats would keep us awake all night. But our doors are closed. I think that's what the general public is understanding, that you need to close your door. And when your door is closed, that buys you the time for the fire department to get there. And we are going to come in and get you, because that's what we train to do. And we definitely need to address the elephant in the room. in today's society with the amount of squatters that we have out there, no building can be considered vacant because people are just everywhere. And you're not, you may have a small house. You might not have, you know, just one to four people. You might have 10 or 12 people inside of a house. So be prepared for that mass casualty incident of search and rescue, especially with all the things that are going on today in our country. We have a lot of people that are coming in. We don't know where they are. We don't inject politics into the fire service when it comes to saving lives and 911. Everyone's equal. We're going to come in and get you. We don't care what your status is. If you're trapped in a building, we're going to come and get you and get you out and care for you. So my advice to the people that are listening to this, make sure that when you commit to search, you're searching 100%. And RJ, you can tell stories as you can as well, Sam. It's not always the houses or the apartments where people are sleeping. You know, people are now, you know, they're sleeping in their businesses. They're sleeping in basements. You might have somebody that might be a line cook in a restaurant, and that's the only place they have, and they sleep there providing security. We need to make sure that we're searching these spaces. We're aggressively, there's that word again, doing that search and making sure that when we roll out, we can honestly say there's nobody in there. And that's one of the things when I was on the dive team in Montgomery County, when we would go diving, and we would be looking for a gun or something like that for the police, or even if we're looking for somebody, and we would do our search and we'd come out and say, they're not there, or that gun's not there. They would always say, well, how do you know? And my answer would be, we didn't find them. So that's how positive we are. And tell your story, RJ, when somebody does a search, and what is the first question you ask them when they're done? What do you ask?
It's so funny, but that's why I was laughing, because I was just teaching another instructor that tactic the other day. So what Dave's talking about, for those that are listening, so when we do a search class, and maybe I'm letting our secret out, but it's okay.
Let's see if they listen and learn.
Yeah, let's see if they're actually paying attention. Maybe we'll switch up how we do business. But for those that are listening that are instructors, one of our first things that we always do when we do a search class or a search drill is the very first evolution. We don't put a victim in right out the gate. So we don't put an evolution. We don't put a victim in the very first evolution. When the evolution is over, usually what I will do is I'll go to that team, to that search team, and I will say to them, did you find anybody in there? And the answer is always going to be no. But then what I like to do is I like to put them on the spot, and then I like to break them down by saying, and I use this exact term. So what you're telling me is if we go in here right now, I'm not going to find a victim in here. Is that what you're telling me? And that's where people usually break down, because they say, they usually start dissecting what they did. And then usually the team leader will be like, whoa, I searched this area and, you know, Jim and Mike searched that area. I wasn't responsible for that. And so usually you get them to kind of break apart and then dissect what each one of them did, so each person can clear their name. And that's what we try to do that on purpose, because we want people to feel like they are responsible for that area, but not the other person. And so I usually will say, so you're telling me right now that if we go in here, I'm not going to find somebody. And then they start playing mind games with themselves, like, oh man, maybe we actually missed somebody. And so the end result is no, there was nobody in there. But what it does is it shows people to be confident in their search, right? So a lot of times people just really are not confident in their work. And I always tell people, you know, you have to be able to answer to the chief, right? The chief says, hey, is Division One, is the search complete? You have to confidently say, yeah, chief, it is complete and negative. And you have to stand behind that. Same thing if you were to do a Division Two. So, you know, hey, is the second floor search complete? Yeah, chief, it's complete and negative, and I am confident with the results. And a lot of times people realize that they did a good search, they're just not confident in their work. And that's the reason why we always do that with the first evolution. You know, I'm also not a big fan of doing, you know, these trainings where we have, you know, seven different victims all, you know, that those situations, yeah, do they happen in real life? They do, but they're not a regular occurrence. You know, a victim or two victims is a very common occurrence. And I was actually just teaching some guys and girls this past weekend and some burn evolutions that we were doing. There's a very good chance if you treat training, but that where you find one, there's generally going to be two. That's a good way to start building up that good kind of confidence as it relates to training or searches as it relates to training. Because, you know, I've made those mistakes in training, you know, where you go find a victim and it's usually an adult victim covering a baby victim or an infant victim as a typical response to any parent. Any one of us who are parents would do the same things if we couldn't get out is protect our kids. We have to treat, well, we need to teach people that same exact thing. So for those listening, that's what Dave's talking about. That's one of our tricks that we do when we teach searches. We never put a victim in the first evolution, but we grill the students real hard about how they did the search and how confident they are with the search. And you know what? Those just a simple question, asking that simple question. So what you're telling me is there's going to be no victims in here. Is that what you're saying? That's enough to break people down. And that's one of our tricks. Dave, we're going to have to switch it. We're going to have to switch it up now that we let the cat off the bag. We have to start putting it on a second search now.
We're at just about 45 minutes, so we got about another 15 minutes, RJ. So let's just keep going, and we'll wind it up.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that what you were talking about was how we conduct business when we do search training,
right?
And for those listening, that's always a good thing to do is to, especially when you have young, inexperienced crews, is to build up their confidence with their search, to be confident to say, yes, I did a good search, and yes, there was nobody here. The problem that we have, and even with experienced guys and girls, you know, you can be trained in good searches, right? And every time we run a box, you know, every time we run a fire, when you do a good search, you don't find anybody. And so essentially what happens is you start building up that energy that every time we go to fire, I'm not going to find somebody. And it's the one that you do where you let your guard down and it catches you backwards. So, you know, I always tell people you have to don't let your mind take over, and you have to always go with that same energy that I am expecting to find somebody in here and that I am going to find somebody in here. And when I do, I am prepared to remove them. And when I don't find anybody in here, I can confidently say I did not find anybody in here because I did a good search through and through. So that's my one point I wanted to bring out about that. And it all stems to training, you know what I mean? And that's one of the things that you brought up, Dave, and how we do that when we travel and teach.
Yeah, and it's no different than when you are riding an engine company and they put out alarm bells. I tell my guys that building is on fire until you say it's not on fire, which means you're wearing your full PPE, your SCBA, you're bringing all your tools. If it's a high rise, you're bringing your standpipe pack, you're bringing your officer's bag. The building is on fire till you say it's not. If you are running a fire, there are people trapped in that house or that apartment or wherever it is until we say that it's all clear. So we have to approach search like we approach our fires. You know, same thing with a car accident. There are people trapped in that vehicle until I get on the scene and say we don't have a rescue. You have to approach that mindset that it's worst case scenario until I prove that it's not. And like you said, RJ, if you keep going in, it's like, we run alarm bells there all the time. It's not on fire. And you half-ass something, the moment that it is on fire, you're playing catch up. And it's the same thing. It's like, there's nobody trapped. It's the middle of the day. Nobody's home. You don't know that. And if you do a half-ass search and you miss somebody because they're in the basement, you know, you got to live with that. So at the end of the day, approach every fire like it's a fire and it's on fire, and you approach every fire like there's people trapped in there, and we search those structures until we say that they're not trapped in there anymore. It's as simple as that.
All right, so I'm gonna throw this up to you guys. I want to hear your thought process on this. All right, so what do you think is the best way to conduct business from an engine company? That's one question that gets asked me a lot. And I like hearing the variations of people's explanations. So you're a three or a four man engine company, and the search needs to be done from the engine company. What is your thought process and how you go about doing that task, especially as a unit officer? What are you guys' thoughts on that? Because I know a lot of people listening, you know, would probably say, hey, you know, I'm an engine, or I don't ride a truck or a squad. So how do I better handle this as a unit officer or a firefighter from an engine company? So share some thoughts you guys have on that concept.
Yeah. You know, I was a company officer for a career company officer for, I don't know, 12 years of my career.
Probably.
Ish, 13 maybe. And even when we went to four person staffing, I had four person staffing on the engine company, at least for most of my career as a company officer. The onus was on me. If I had a backup man or a backup firefighter, I needed that backup firefighter to do backup things. And if not, I had double duty. Tacoma Park was a real good example. Like, so we were searching, you know, we were stretching the line in. I'm searching as we're advancing the hose line in. The driver was responsible for the hose all the way to the door. And they knew that all three shifts, that's the way they operated. They knew they had three people. They knew, you know, sometimes the stretch once they passed that door was long, and sometimes they'd even go in there and chase it, you know, chase it to the floor of or outside the apartment or whatever. But, you know, the onus is on the company officer. I need my firefighters focused on getting that hose line in place and putting the fire out. No, they don't need the distraction to search. I can do both. It's not optimal. We don't live in a perfect world. But as a company officer, I knew I could both supervise my firefighters, make sure they're doing what they need to do, and search off the hose line. I always carried a Halligan bar with me, so I always had a tool to assist with extending out if I needed to, that kind of thing. So, yeah, definitely that's what's up.
I think that you can't even improve on what you said, Sam, because all those points are valid. The biggest thing is, you know, being on an engine company, especially if it's a four-person engine company, that's two dudes pulling that line, or two people pulling that line, getting it in place, and that frees that officer up a little bit, especially if you have a seasoned crew. You know, they know where to go and go put that fire out. The chance of you having two rookies on the line is slim in a combination or a career department. The key is, like you said, that officer has to have a hand tool. He's got to bring a hand tool with him. If you're going in that front door with empty hands, regardless of what you're riding, then you're not doing your job. The lineman, his tool is the hose line. The backup man, in my opinion, should be bringing a hook with him, even if he leaves it at the door, because the moment that fire's out, you start overhaul. Can't always rely on the truck. But being able to search off that hose line as you're pushing down the hallway is key. And an engine company can handle that. Of course, what Andy Frederick says, you put water on the fire, all the problems go away. So you get that. If you've got a room and contents fire and you can quickly get that line in place and get water on the fire, say within a minute of hitting that front door, then the search is going to be done pretty quick. If you've got a well-advanced fire, you're going to need to protect that search. So you're going to need to get a line between the fire and where you're searching. So obviously you want to search from the dangerous areas back, but being on an engine company, you're moving from the least dangerous areas to the dangerous areas, and you're searching as you're moving forward. But everything that Sam said is key, in my opinion. We are tasked to do a lot on the fire ground. I've said it 1,000 times, you know, I tell my engine crews, where's your hook? Well, I'm not a truck company. All right, well, let me ask you a question. That door is locked. Are you waiting for the truck to get on the scene to open it for you? The answer is
nope.
No. You know, we carry tools on the rig for a purpose. So sometimes we got to do dual purpose. I've been on a truck company where I've had a hose line in my hand, and I've been in a battalion as a Ford division, and I've had a hand line. I understand that I'm no longer strategy once I put that tool in my hand. But when crews are moving around, you know, sometimes you need to hit a hot spot till that next crew can come in. But the end of the story is you have to be versatile to be able to do both.
Yeah. So I think that's a good topic, and I threw that up just because I know people listening find themselves in that same predicament. Like, hey, I'm not a truck, I'm not a squad, I'm an engine. So what are you guys' stance on that? And, you know, one of the biggest things that is a complicated portion of this is a lot of times your officer is the more experienced person. So the catch 22 is, does the officer leave that person or that crew to manage the line and he or she go off and do the search? Or does the officer break off that person to go do the search? You know, I never want to tell people you have to do this, you have to do that. It's just things that you need to put in perspective. You need to play out the situation. You know, just like we always say, you know, there's no always and 100% in the fire service, but you got to be able to read the room, right? So, you know, if this particular situation is warranting where it's not maybe the best idea to send somebody else to do it, you know, making sure that line is in place to be able to protect, you know, one of us to do the search, I think that all comes down to good training as well. If we can teach people how to manage a hand line so that we can protect people while they're doing searches, that's all helping with the search itself, you know. And one of the things I do want to throw out there that comes up quite a bit. People ask me a lot is how what's the flow for removing victims? What's the flow of when we find people taking them out? You know, I was breaking this down to some young guys and girls the other day while we were doing our burns. And you know, one of the things that I was always taught at a young age is I hope for life. All right. So I hope for life is an acronym for the order in which we remove victims. So I hope for life, the acronym is I, which is interior stairs, H, which is horizontal exits, four, your F, that's fire escapes or balconies. And then life is L for ladders. So that is how I was always taught to remove victims. And somebody asked me, what's the reason why ladders is the last one? And, you know, a lot of times people don't realize how task consuming, how many people it takes to remove a victim down a ladder. You know, remember Irish Street, that fight we had on Irish Street?
They did the window cut down. Oh my gosh,
that lady. Yeah. And I mean, when I was picking that lady up, me and those guys up on the second floor,
that lady was probably. When I came in from home.
That lady. Yeah,
I heard you on the radio, and I drove 110 miles an hour in a Honda Element down 95 from Baltimore City to get there because I was so worried that you were, and you guys took a shellacking in that fire.
But you know, the crazy thing is a lot of times people don't realize that when we take somebody down a ladder, that requires lots of people, and we weren't even moving somebody big. I mean, we were moving a small, older, elderly person. I felt like we were moving an elephant, you know? And so, like, not only getting that object, that person from the floor, you have to get that person from the floor up and out of a window. And then that usually requires another ladder or more multiple people on the ladders. So that's the reason why I was trying to explain that ladders is usually down, like, one of the later options. But yeah, I just wanted to share that with people because you know, it's funny how, you know, little things like that are taught to us that we learn, sometimes we fall short on making sure that we get that information or share that information with other people. But I hope for life was one of the ones that was always taught to me. Interior stairs, horizontal exits, fire escapes or balconies, and ladders. So yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there real quick.
And to tack on what you said, RJ, as we're getting ready to wrap up here, you know, people need to understand that a 130-pound unconscious person weighs at least 400 pounds when you're trying to take them out of a window because it's dead weight. And then on top of that, it's easily one of two things. They're either burned, so you can't get a good grip on them, or they're already naked. Or whatever loose clothing they're wearing, it's coming off. So those interior stairs, think how quick you can move horizontally downstairs and out the front door. You know, that's the normal way they go. It's funny you talk about Irish Street, but if you guys remember, there was a fire on Irish Street about a year prior to that. And we ended up having to do that vent enter search. And I was on that particular one, and we did a window cut down.
Yeah, that's the one.
That lady was quite sizable.
Yeah.
And it took everything we had, probably about 10 firefighters, to get her out from the floor because it was hoarding conditions. off the bed, on the ladder, and down. And it took every bit of 25 minutes to get her out and down because of the hoarding condition. So that interior stairs is the way to go. And then one more thing I want to bring up before we go around the horn. You talk about that engine company, that single engine company rolling up on the scene and being able to do that search and who's going to do the search. All that needs to be played out long before that fire ever comes in. So if you're the officer of that shift, those are expectations that you put to your people, and then you go out and you practice that. Hey, we're going to pull a line while you guys are pushing down the hallway. I'm going to start searching these rooms. You know, when you have those acquired structures, like we talked about in the beginning of this, practice those things. Even if it's like, hey, we're going to pull a dry line into the firehouse, and as you guys are pushing down the hallway, I'm going to search back and forth on the room, and we're going to meet here. So those expectations need to be pushed out long before the fire happens, and then you need to train on that. So when it does happen, small moves. You know, you go that way, get the water on the fire, I'm going to start searching these rooms. We know we've done this before in training. Now we've got it. So like Frank likes to say, we're at the witching hour. Great topic. And
again, Frank was at the witching hour 10 minutes into this thing.
He would have done an Irish goodbye if he could, but we had him on here. We could talk about search all the time. I'm really excited moving this radio show, this podcast forward. Just being able to talk in tactics with you guys, and we'll have different guests, different friends, new people that we think can really contribute to the conversation, trusted people that we know that are going to give good information out there. And the whole key is just to be able to pass on the stuff that we've learned along the way, pass on things that we learned recently that we can pass on along the way, the things that we learn, because we are always students of this this profession, and we're always learning. So around the horn, RJ, last words?
Yeah, I just really would like to say thank you to Frank and Chief Rhodes and all of the people at Fire Engineering for allowing us to take this Monday night show and put it out there for the masses. It's really cool that people respect us and trust us with such an exciting kind of endeavor. So thank you to them. And then as we wrap up tonight's segment, I would like to say, as it relates to a search, please, guys and girls, make sure you guys are getting on these sites. Like I said, Firefighter Rescue Survey, a lot of this information, which is good as it relates to our job and this particular task, is really good information, and it helps with the task that we're trying to do. Making sure that you understand what your department's culture is as it relates to search, and if you don't have one, building one, right? And the only way you can build one is by doing good training and getting everybody involved, right? So when we do hold a search training, we get our battalion chiefs involved, we get our upper management involved to see how we're doing these tasks, how we're training, how we're going in to find people, and whether we find people or not during these trainings. That's how we build confidence, not only in ourselves, but in our administration and our chiefs who are sending us on these tasks. So, the culture is one of the biggest things I would like to leave people with, just making sure that you build yourself a, here we go, aggressive search culture, and also, just building that confidence within yourself. So thank you to Fire Engineering, Dave and Sam and Frank and everybody. Chief Rose, thank you guys for having us and letting us talk about search tonight.
Sam?
Yeah, thanks. I'll echo what RJ said. Listen, Frank and Fire Engineering have provided me with so many opportunities that I never asked for. Frank's always been like, he talking about passing it forward, man. One of the biggest things he's taught me is how to pass it forward. I've seen him do it. He's such a humble guy about it. He's put me up in his apartment, his hotel room at FDIC. He pushed me to present. Got me a pass to attend before, and then this, and Fire Engineering I've learned so much from the people that have presented through them. A lot of them were my heroes, like a lot of people will tell you about me, especially like the FDNY is kind of like my New York Yankees. I don't watch baseball, but man, I buffed the hell out of Jobs. And a lot of those hard chargers from FDNY present, and I've gotten a lot from them too. And it's been an honor and a privilege to do that. You know, those words get tossed around a lot, but truly I feel like I've been presented with so many privileges through fire engineering, and I owe a lot of it to the folks there, and obviously to Frank, man. We love you so much. And thanks for entrusting us with this awesome endeavor.
Cool. All right, fellas. Well, until next month, thanks a lot for listening, and we're gone.
Did you know the risk of cancer does not stop at the scene of the fire? Firefighters are constantly exposed to diesel exhaust fumes and other airborne toxins that get trapped inside the station, leading to cancer. Protect yourself with MagnaGrip. Through the combination of MagnaGrip exhaust removal systems and AirHawk air purification systems, only MagnaGrip eliminates 100% of all cancer-causing toxins within the station. Learn more at MagnaGrip.com.
In the world of firefighting and public safety, reliability is key. That's why for over two decades, first responders nationwide have trusted the Fire Store as their go-to source for essential equipment, apparel, and accessories. From top-of-the-line firefighting gear like helmets, boots, and thermal imaging cameras, the Fire Store has it all, tailored to the specific needs of our heroes on the front lines. But they don't stop there. Their extensive selection also includes EMS supplies, safety apparel like flame-resistant clothing and high-visibility gear, as well as a wide array of tools from hand tools to vehicle extrication tools, supporting public safety professionals in their duties. Partnered with industry leaders, the Fire Store's commitment to quality and excellence is unmatched, because when it comes to protecting communities, there's no room for compromise. Join the thousands of first responders who rely on the Fire Store. Visit thefirestore.com online or in-store today. The Fire Store, your reliable partner for fire and public safety equipment.